7.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is something encouraging in the chance to begin a program by saying there's trouble in Israel today, but also to say that the trouble is political, that it doesn't involve bombs or bullets. Israel's ruling coalition has collapsed. The unity government is breaking up. It was the Labor Party that precipitated the split, stalking out behind its leader, Binyamin Ben-Eliezer, in a dispute over money. Should the government be building new settlements, or should it set that money aside for the poor? And it's not that there isn't a genuine difference of opinion there, but it seems the current drama has much more to do with leadership politics. With Ben-Eliezer's own plans to lead Labor and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's control of Likud, his control of the army and the agenda. Connection listeners, we'd like to look beyond the complicated mix of partnerships and coalitions and personalities to what it means, or what it will mean for Israel and the Palestinians and the peace process. Is this a moment that could lead to substantial change, either a hardening of the right or a rebirth of opposition? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to hear from all sides in Israel on this today, as well as the American perspective. We're going to start with Cameron Barr. He's a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, and he's standing by in Jerusalem. Hi, Cameron.
Hi.
What's the latest here? Now, is the unity government actually finished, or is there still a window where Labor could come back?
There's still a window under the parliamentary system here. Resignations don't become effective immediately, but I think most analysts believe that Labor is out of the coalition, and we're in a sort of a new, more fragmented Israeli political universe. You know, for nearly 20 months, there's been a coalition government that has presented a united face to the world, but it's also had the effect of stifling the debate, since it's included, you know, the two leading parties in Israel, Labor and the Likud, who have been historical rivals. And now those parties are in opposition, and at least the Labor is in opposition. And that, analysts think, will invigorate the debate and shake things up as we prepare for elections that must be held within a year's time.
Now, while Ben-Eliezer and the Labor Party are busy off settling their own affairs, what are the choices facing Prime Minister Sharon at this moment?
Well, he has an immediate concern, which is a no-confidence measure, which is coming before the parliament, the Knesset, on Monday. And so he is now seeking the support of small right-wing parties on the fringe of the Israeli spectrum in order to get through that immediate hurdle. And the people that I've been speaking with today think he'll do that. I think in the near term, beyond this sort of next few days, his government will at least look more right-wing, simply because it won't be in coalition with the Labor. Now, whether to what extent it moves to the right, that's a question for debate. It will make the Americans very uncomfortable if Sharon moves aggressively to the right. It will not make it easier for the Americans to marshal any sort of support in the Arab world for a move against Iraq if its Israeli allies are further antagonizing the situation on the ground. So that's one curb on Sharon.
Cameron, I know you're on deadline. I'm going to let you go. Thanks very much for your time this
Thank
morning.
Thank you.
Cameron
Thank
Bars, you. Middle East correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Jerusalem. We're joined now by Ambassador Philip Wilcox. He's president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington. He is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Middle Eastern Affairs. He also served as Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism. Welcome to the program, Ambassador.
Nice to be with you, Dick.
And joining us on the line from Jerusalem is a member of the Knesset, Benny Elon. He is head of Meledet, which is part of the Ichud Leumi Yisrael Beitenu party. Now, that's one of the right-wing parties Cameron was referring to that's currently being courted by Ariel Sharon. So, Benny Elon, I'd like to begin with you. Are you going to rejoin the Likud party? Are you coming back to government?
I don't know. I just can tell you that I think that the unity government
was good for a while, but economically and also in the security and also the nationalist point of view, they, instead of being together and instead of bringing unity, they start to blackmail one each other. So wild and wide government with quantity, without one policy and without quality, I think the best thing now is to establish maybe a little bit narrow but right-wing government that at least will be one voice and one leadership, and I hope that everyone, including me, will have enough responsibility to have it strong at least for a year.
Mr. Alon, one of the principles of the Moledet movement, the homeland movement, is the idea of moving Palestinians out of the territories, out of the West Bank and Gaza. Are you saying that that's the sort of policy which could become government policy if your party were to join with Likud at this point?
I want to remind you that I was in the government, in the unity government, with the same platform.
Right.
I never tried to force my platform and to say that all of the government have to obey to my platform. This is the kind of democracy. If you have a coalition with a few parties, you have to know about what you agree and if you can go together. I really think that if I'll have once the chance and the opportunity, and I have to thank you for the honor to be with you, I'll be more than happy to explain why in our area no peace will be if we shall not solve the Palestinian refugee problem. And the Palestinian refugee problem cannot be solved if we'll not give real solution to those that suffer 54 years in refugee camps, and if we shall not give them new chance by resettling them, by relocating them, but by giving them assistance, no peace will be in the area. But I can imagine that you can't give me a few hours to explain it.
No, I don't, unfortunately, have a few hours. I would ask you to stay with us. I want to bring the ambassador in on this point of where the turmoil places the peace process. Ambassador, look at it from a perspective that takes us out of the internal party politics of Israel, and tell me, does everything just go on ice for the time being?
No, I don't think so. Israeli politics have always been unpredictable and volatile. The fall of the unity government, I think, will bring about a long-awaited and much-needed realignment in Israeli politics, in which an opposition is restored. It may produce a renewed Labor Party, which will perform its traditional role as the party of peace and the party of compromise with the Arabs and the party of social justice. And that would be a good thing. And if not in the next election, at some early stage, that could renew a genuine peace process, which has utterly collapsed.
Benny Alon, that's the flip side here, isn't it? That the collapse of the unity government, as the ambassador is saying, could reinvigorate the peace movement in Israel. In fact, put the right-wing parties further on the margin. Is that a possibility in your view?
In all of the due respect to the ambassador, I really think that we have to be with two legs on the ground, and we have to understand that we have no partner, and the high expectations that we had for the Oslo Accords brought just deep disappointment, and I don't see how we can bring damage. We want to prevent bloodshed, and I really think that if we'll continue to close our eyes and to be blind, and we'll bring peace, so-called peace plans that will be just compromised without any reality, it will bring another bloodshed. So maybe national government that will not speak in two voices and will not confuse everyone, that Shimon Peres said something, say A, and Arik Sharon says B. Maybe if it will be one clear voice, it will be easy to the Arabs and to the rest to understand what we want.
Last question, Mr. Alon. If that does not happen in this current period of turmoil. Are you fairly confident that that voice, which you hope Israel will present to the Arab world, will be the voice that will be heard after the next election?
No one can be sure, but at least according to the polls, according to the feeling on the streets after the suffering of 2 years since Arafat started the riots in September 2000 and after more than 600 victims and bombing suicides, etc., I really think that something happened in the Israeli opinion, I really think that maybe this government, maybe another prime minister, maybe the same prime minister, but I think that the direction after the elections will continue to be for more a clear voice and to say what we are, why we are here, and not just to give territory for peace when they really don't appreciate the peace and they want us not to appreciate the territory.
Benny Alon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Alon is a member of the Knesset. He's head of Meledet, part of the Hud Leumi Yisrael Beitenu party. That's one of the right-wing parties currently being courted by Ariel Sharon in the wake of the collapse of the coalition, the unity government in Israel. Ambassador Philip Wilcox, give me your sense of what Benny's suggesting, that maybe, in fact, Labor has lost its standing in Israel by sitting too close to Ariel Sharon for the past, 18, 19 months?
From my vantage point, indeed, the Labor Party, to an extent, has been discredited by this odd marriage with Sharon. It has weakened the moderate and the left in the Labor Party, and has confused the goals of the Labour Party by freeing themselves from this entanglement. I think perhaps the Labour Party will be obliged to create more clarity and focus in its policy, and it may well be that it will restore that emphasis on peace, compromise with the Arabs, and social justice.
What about the idea that if you read the polls, that the shift has been substantially to the right, to a more hardline attitude?
I think there has been such a shift as a result of the Intifada and the perception that has been promoted heavily by Sharon that there is no Palestinian partner. Mr. Alon mentioned this as well, and that therefore there's no real prospect of peace or compromise with the Palestinians, and that the Israel is therefore obliged to crush the Palestinians by violence and continue its policies of occupation.
But you think that can swing back?
Yes, I do. I think there's a deep longing in the Israeli public for peace. I think, indeed, there is an understanding that peace will require an Israeli withdrawal substantially to the 1967 Green Line and the dismantlement of most of the settlements. The question is how to get there. Sharon's objective is to prevent that from happening. The Labour Party's obligation is to come up with an alternative.
Let me interrupt you there, Ambassador. We're going to pick that up when we continue with the question that you pose, and pose well. How to get there, as Israel politics is in a period of some considerable turmoil for the two leading parties, possibility of election, maybe a new coalition. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the current political situation in Israel. The unity government has collapsed as the Labour Party walks out. In their excuse for the departure is disagreement over money being set aside for the settlements instead of money being put aside for social programs. But in fact, it's such a small amount of money in the budget that most observers are looking at it and saying that this was, in fact, Labour leader Ben Eliezer's opportunity to leave the coalition so he could place himself against his two challengers in the Labour Party, and now a challenge also for Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Does he rebuild a coalition? Does he go to elections? With me on the program, Ambassador Philip Wilcox, President of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington. Let's go to our first caller in Savannah, Georgia. Omar's on the line. Hi, Omar.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. I think what, at least from the Arab side, is really looking at this with regards to this collapse and the reason of the collapse of the settlements, kind of with caution and a bit of cynicism, you know, that the Labour Likud parties have been doing this sort of thing where a government will collapse and another one will come. It's since Ben-Gurion and Moshe Sharat's time at the beginning of the political history of Israel. And quite frankly, I think what's happening is that Ariel Sharon has done his job with the dismantling of the Palestinian Authority, and now Labour is going to come in and kind of take the reins. But it's kind of ironic that there's the question of the settlements, because the Labour Party, in fact, has been responsible for the majority of the settlements built in the West Bank and Gaza and the occupied territory.
You're saying it's a sort of good cop, bad cop routine that's looking a little transparent, right?
I hate to put it that way, but yes, so there's really not much optimism right now, I don't think, in the Arab street, so to speak, or any of the other governments in Arab governments in the Middle East.
Ambassador, we were talking about that earlier, the lack of optimism of that a Labour voice will become different or louder or sort of reestablish itself as opposition.
Well, Omar makes a good point. Indeed, the Labour Party establishment and the Likud have in fact been partners in settlement expansion over these many years. Settlements are usually identified with the Likud, but the various Labour leaders had their role in expanding settlements, including the last Labour Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, who worked to expand settlements during his two-year term. Even Yitzhak Rabin allowed settlements to expand during the 1993-2000 period when the Oslo process was supposed to be unfolding. The settlement population of the West Bank and Gaza grew from 100,000 to 200,000. The overall settler population in all the occupied territories is now 500,000. Nevertheless, I think the Israeli public is growing increasingly disillusioned with settlements, and the breakdown of the unity government and Ben Eliezer's choice to focus on settlements as a reason for that is a very good thing. And I hope will launch a broader debate within Israeli society about the settlement phenomenon, which is the single and most important obstacle to peace, and if it continues, will doom the Israelis and the Palestinians to, I think, a perpetual conflict.
Omar, thanks for your call. Let's bring Zeb Schiff into the conversation. He's a military analyst for the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's been on the program before. Hello, Zeb.
Good morning to all of you. I just listened to what my colleague, Mr. Omar, told us. Let me be more precise here. There's a huge difference between the Labour Party approach towards settlement and the Likud Party approach. One is to remember that it is true that the Labour Party were the first to add settlements. But the difference, the major difference, is that when the Labour Party did it, they established settlements in unpopulated areas, like the Jordan Valley, not in the populated areas in the near Nablus, near Ramallah, and so on, because they thought about the future territorial compromise. The difference is that when the Likud party came into power, and Sharon was then Minister of Agriculture and then later Minister of Defense, they started to build the settlements mainly, or may I say only, in the populated areas in order to just to prevent any establishment of a viable Palestinian state. This is something which one has to remember. And once again, I mean, we are not fair to the late Mr. Rabin, because he stopped all the money. He didn't fund any settlements. They brought the money from private loans, but not from the government. And actually, one of the reasons that he was finally killed by someone originally from the settlements was that he saw them as a sort of an obstacle. And when it comes to Barak, the difference was that during his period of time, we saw more people moving to settlements, not new settlements, but
Zev,
more people
Zev,
moving.
Can I interrupt
to
you for a minute here?
I want to finish with this. Strongholds, and therefore this was an obstacle, but not the only obstacle. The terror was another obstacle, and you have to remember it.
Now, you're a military analyst for Haaretz. I'm interested in what happens next? There's no defense minister. Ben Eliezer was defense minister. There's no foreign minister. Shimon Peres was foreign minister. So where does the policy, where does the decision-making come from now?
This is a major issue, and believe it or not, this is exactly what my column, which I'm writing at this moment, when you called me. This is a question which a question mark that we don't know how it's going to take us, because there was a certain with the National Unity Government, with Peres and Ben Eliezer as the defense minister, we had certain checks and balances within the cabinet, or what we call the kitchenette, where the major decisions were taken by three, four ministers. I'm not sure. I'm quite afraid that we are going to lose the checks and balances if we shall see just a narrow right-wing government. And this is the danger, actually, because we see on the ground, this is usually a compromise after a long debate in this in a cabinet, and now we shall see a group of people that they resemble to each other. So you don't have this kind of checks and balances, and it reminds me. This is what worries me. That it reminds me of the inner cabinet in 1982 on the eve of the Lebanon War. And this is a danger. There is no doubt that this is a danger.
Zev, I want to go back to callers if I can just get you to...
differently, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Zev.
And therefore, if we shall see an unbalanced cabinet... the inner cabinet, it can bring us to a sort of extreme reactions. If we shall see tomorrow, let us say, a mega terror act in Israel, the response can be really much tougher. But one has to remember that Israel is not isolated. We have we are not just with the Palestinians alone in this world. And Mr. Sharon just came back from Washington, and this was an issue which was discussed on the backdrop of the possible future war in Iraq.
Zev, you have to let me in here. I need to go back to our callers. Let's hear from Peter in Lexington, Massachusetts. Peter.
Well, I wanted to raise the issue of of Islam worldwide and the effect that might have on Israeli perceptions. I have always thought, and I now think that the reality was there, but the perception is now catching up with the reality, that the clearly declared hostility to infidels worldwide in the Quran and the Hadith, and the division of the world between Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, the domain of the infidel, that must be pushed back, is relevant, is obviously relevant to the infidel state of Israel in the midst of an Arab-Muslim domain.
Peter, can I ask you whether or not what you're sort of moving towards is that the sharpening sense of conflict that an American attack on Iraq and the world, I mean, the war on terrorism has done to divide the two sides, and whether or not that's going to affect this vote?
No, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the ideology of Islam, which apologists ignore. Redefining jihad or concentrating on the personal aspects of worship, not on the geopolitics of it. I'm saying that the Arab assault on Israel is part of a, is similar to what goes on in Kashmir, Bosnia, in Indonesia with attack. In general, Israel is simply unacceptable because it is an infidel state on what is regarded as Arab-Muslim territory. Its size is irrelevant.
Peter, thanks for your call. Ambassador, to you.
I strenuously disagree with Peter. I remind him that when the Prophet Muhammad created the Compact of Medina, which was the first Islamic constitution, it called for tolerance of other faiths. Islam, like Judaism and Christianity, is a religion of tolerance. It is not a religion of violence. There are deviant extremist groups in Islam, as there are in other faiths, that promote intolerance, division, and justify violence. They are a minority. The Arab-Israeli dispute is, in its essence, now the dispute between Israel and the Palestinians. It's not a religious war, although there are those who would like to turn it into a religious war on the fringes. It is a war of two competing nationalisms, two people who want states of their own, a dispute over land to which they both have.
Do you think people like Peter, who take that point of view, have a greater constituency these days?
I think there are those who genuinely believe that there is a primordial confrontation between Islam and the West, Islam and Judaism. I don't believe that for a moment. I think it's false. It's a misreading of history. It shows a misunderstanding of Islam. To promote that point of view, I think, is to only make the situation worse.
Zev Schiff, Israeli voters last went to the polls in March 2001, I believe. When Israeli voters go to the polls again, whether or not it's in 3 or 4 months, perhaps a little bit longer than that, if Mr. Sharon is able to rebuild a coalition, will, in your view, the people be voting with a completely different mindset?
I'm not sure, because the settlements is a major issue. There is no doubt of it. And this is was the straw which broke the camel's back, because we went to these negotiations, and the Likud and Sharon refused that the settlements will be the budget will be controlled. Now, next elections, I think that we should see two things, actually, or major issue. Settlements will be an issue when we should come to negotiations. There's no doubt about it. It will be a major issue. Refugees and settlements. But when we shall go to the ballots in a few months, possibly, the major issue will be terror and if there is a peace plan, not just settlements. Settlements is part of it. This will be the leading questions.
Let's go to Sally Reshef, who's been listening in, waiting on the line. Mr. Reshef is a member of the Knesset. He's also a member of the Labour Party and from the Peace Now movement. Welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you?
I'm fine. As you look, well, let me back up a little bit. Earlier in the program, we were talking about what the future of Labour will be, whether or not Labour has lost its opportunity to present a strong opposition to the Likud government after so many months in coalition. What's your view about that?
Well, I've always been against our participation in this government, and I think that we lost a lot of our ability to talk to the Israeli public as a result of being part of this coalition. Even though the idea of a national unity government is a popular one, it led to the conclusion of the Israeli public that the existing policy of the government of Sharon is the only viable policy, a thesis that I completely disagree with. I think that right now the decision to leave the government, even though maybe its timing was not great, but the mere decision that we will not be a part of this government anymore, that we will elect new leadership to the party, and that we will once again try to present to the public an alternative to the policy of Sharon, which is a policy of using force and force and more force and without really giving any hope to the public of trying to reopen a possibility of negotiations with the Palestinians. I think that the Labour has a long way to go in order to overcome the problems of the last few years, including the very serious crisis in negotiations with the Palestinians. But I believe that it is not impossible to change our status in the next few months.
Do you think that the differences between Labour and Likud, as they were being described earlier by Zev Schiff, will come down to the way the two parties define their positions on settlements? Is that going to be the key issue?
Settlements is one issue, but I think that where Labour will have to concentrate in the next elections is by presenting to the public a viable way out of the existing deadlock. It is clear that Sharon has no way out of this deadlock. He's been proving it for the last 2 years. I mean, at a certain point, he even stopped trying to present it as if he had a program to move back to the diplomatic arena. Labour, I think, will not be able to come to the public and say, look, we have a reliable partner with whom we can come to a final agreement now about all the issues, settlements, borders, Jerusalem, refugees. I think that this is going to be impossible in the next campaign if we want to talk the truth to the public. But I think that Labour should and will develop some kind of a plan for what I call a comprehensive interim agreement, which will be an agreement according to which we will withdraw from additional parts of the West Bank. There should be a commitment by the Palestinians to once again fight terror and cooperate on security issues.
Mr. Recep, I have to interrupt you there because we're stepping away for a short break. We will continue that when we come back on The Connection. Our number 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program this hour, Zev Schiff, military analyst for the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Sally Reshef is with us. He's a member of the Knesset, a co-founder of Peace Now, and a member of the Labour Party. Ambassador Philip Wilcox, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Middle Eastern Affairs, is also with us. Ambassador, I'm going to start with you just to get a sense from you of what the U.S. role is in here. The White House says this is all internal. We take our hands off at this point. But there is a peace proposal, a roadmap on the table. Is it to be given any weight, any credibility at this point?
Well, the U.S. has always been careful not to intervene in an overt way in Israeli elections. But the United States has an enormous role to play in restoring peace, and the Israeli public reacts to American views. The Bush administration has been quite passive, in fact. It's been preoccupied with Iraq and the war on terrorism. The current roadmap, as it is called, I think is a placeholder. It is a warmed over a collection of ideas that have been presented and which have not succeeded in the past. Its major flaw, I fear, is that it proposes yet another interim phased process. And the Oslo process broke down because it was phased and because there was no recognized end game that both parties could look to and which would give them hope. So I don't think the current administration's policy. Certainly, it's not the last word.
Right.
It hasn't been presented with much emphasis, and indeed, it's almost been almost died at birth because Prime Minister Sharon has said that there will be no freeze on settlements, and that, of course, would defeat any new process.
Let's go to Brighton, Massachusetts. Margot's on the line. Hi, Margot.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. Listen to the same conversation over and over again. Nobody's getting anywhere. America has to get the hell out, and we have no business being there. This is like we're beating the same dead horse 40 years later.
Sally Reshef, what would happen if the United States did exactly what Margot is suggesting?
Well, I think I tend to agree on this issue with Mr. Wilcox and not with Margot, because I think that it's that the intervention of the United States is crucial for the area. It played a very important role in certain developments in the Middle East, starting with the Carter administration and then the Bush-Baker administration, and then with very serious efforts of President Clinton. And I still hope that President Bush is also going to be more involved. But I would like to refer to the comment that Mr. Wilcox made about phasing the process. I do agree that some of the explanation to the failure of Oslo was the phasing of the process, but I think that it was a necessity and still is a necessity, because it's impossible for the parties then and now to reach a comprehensive agreement. I think that the conclusions that we should draw from the failure of Oslo is that when I talk about a comprehensive interim agreement, I'm still talking about phases, but I'm talking about a phase in which the two parties will show that they really intend to move towards the end of the process. For instance, I think that Israel, in this temporary agreement, should give back something like 85% of the West Bank and should remove between 40 to 50 settlements. So the problem with the Oslo process was that we were talking about getting out of the territories but continued to build settlements like crazy, and the Palestinians talked about making peace with Israel but continued dealing with the terror and forbidding it and enforcing the law against the terrorists. I think that if we draw the conclusion and we move to a comprehensive interim agreement, not something which will be the end of the conflict, but something which will give the two parties the real belief that they both intend to move out of the conflict, that Israel is moving out of the West Bank and it shows that it's on its way out, and the Palestinians make a serious effort to stop terror. And
let me just step in here, if I can, and bring Margot back into the conversation, Margot, because I mean, I know what you're saying when you say you have heard much of this same conversation before, but for the United States to on the basis of that, say we have no business in the Middle East, is that a creative solution?
Well, it's creative if we're being blamed because it's our weapons or our money funding the weapons that's being blamed, and this is angering the world, the people in the entire world, not just one particular religious or political group. They're mad. They're like, get your money and your weapons out of here. Okay, we'll do that. We'll help you solve the conflict. Let's get some really creative people in there to solve the conflict. I don't know who, some Quakers or somebody. Let's get some new minds in there. Like, this is the same conversation that has been going on. I mean, it's escalated now. I hear it every day on your show practically, and it's just so tedious. Like, can't we open our minds a little bit and think, all right, let's just pull the weapons out. I'm not going to stop if you don't stop. It's just this stupid cycle of, I'm sorry, ignorant men. There's like 15 men who are in charge of the world, and they're waiting for the day that it'll end. Like, I don't really want to go there.
So, Zev Schiff, we're going round and round and round and round.
You see, I don't agree with Margot, because one has to keep in mind that this is not just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, the United States is going now after Saddam Hussein and the weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, many mistakes were done in the past, but one has to remember that without the United States, there is no peace there. Even if both sides do initiate meetings and negotiations, we always need the United States to come at a certain stage and help us. The same happened between Israel and Sadat and within Oslo as well. And therefore, the United States did it, and more than the Europeans, because the Europeans couldn't solve even the slightest conflict in Europe by themselves. Always they asked the Americans to come in, even in Ireland or in Kosovo and so on. Therefore, we need the United States. They can help both parties, and one is to keep, and mistakes were done. There's no doubt of it. And the roadmap, which is still a half empty glass, but one has to pay attention to the opening of the plan, where they are saying these are the elements of performance-based plan, which means because the mistakes which were done before, after Oslo, because not just terror and settlements, but also incitement and so on, meaning that one will be responsible for the supervision of it.
Ambassador, I wonder whether or not you would be commiserating with Margot or reassuring her.
Well, I certainly think the United States has responsibilities to itself to protect our interests in the region. But I think we also have an obligation to the Israelis and the Palestinians. After all, we've been involved as an intermediary now for some 50 years. We've made powerful commitments to support the security and well-being of Israel, and we're also committed, I believe, to justice for the Palestinians via a two-state solution. I can't imagine the United States withdrawing from the conflict. It's frustrating indeed, and I share Margot's frustration. We've got to keep at it, and we've got to try harder.
Salih Reshef, let me go back to you as a co-founder of Peace Now and looking at an opportunity to sort of recast either the movement or your role in the Labour Party. It's been a very, very quiet group of people over the past 12, 16 months. You know, when you look at what's happened in Gaza or Yanun or Jenin and places where we would have in years past expected to hear some pretty vocal protests from Peace Now, the organization's been very quiet. Is that about to change, or is that just the way things should have been?
Well, you should realize that there happened very serious developments in the attitude of Israel towards the West Bank and the military actions that Israel took. But you should realize that the Israeli public lived in the last 2 years under a constant terrorist attack and with a lot of fear for our own survival. And this is not exactly the environment which makes it clear, which makes it easy to protest against.
Right, and there's no indication that's about to change, is there?
Well, look, we have been active in one way or the other. We did try and still are trying to protest against things that we did not believe in. But I think that something very thorough has to happen on both sides for the people who believe in peace to be strong again politically and publicly. I'm optimistic. I believe it can be done. I believe we have a role. I believe we will play the role that we have. But it certainly has been a very tough period for all people in the region, certainly for the people who have been fighting for peace for the last 30 years or so.
Zeb Schiff, tell me who we should be watching in the months ahead. Is Benjamin Netanyahu about to take over from Mr. Sharon? Is Ben Eliezer going to hang on into the Labour Party? Are we looking at a big change of the characters?
Yeah, we have to see who is going to be the next head of the Labour Party. We have to see who is going to win in the Likud party. Either Sharon will go on, and he has his leadership, but I'm really doubtful if he's a real statesman. And not to forget for a moment that we have to see who is emerging in the Palestinian camp, because if I'm reading well what their response to the American proposal about the roadmaps, they are not thinking about electing or choosing a prime minister at this stage. which means Arafat still wants to stay there and to lead the Palestinian camp. So we have to see not just what's happening in our side, but also in the Palestinian side.
And could that perhaps, Ambassador, be one of the crucial features in the new conversation if we take our starting point from Margot's frustration?
Certainly, not only does U.S. diplomacy and U.S. views about the substance of peace have a big impact on Israeli public opinion, so does the actions of the Palestinians. And it is true that the Palestinian terrorism has frightened the Israeli public and has played right into the hands of the Israeli right, who has explained that as clear evidence that the Palestinians only want to destroy Israel and do not want peace. I don't believe that's true, but it is essential that the Palestinians contain and ultimately halt terrorism if there is to be a renewed peace process and the withdrawal from settlements, the creation of a Palestinian state. That is unlikely to happen, though, unless there is a greater incentive to the Palestinians, and it is there that the U.S. has to play a role, I believe, in presenting a vision of peace to both Israelis and Palestinians, which would encourage them to push their leaders in the right direction.
And, of course, you never get to actually plan things out the way they're supposed to go. Ambassador, briefly, the United Nations is busy looking at a UN resolution that could bring weapons inspectors and move a war with Iraq much closer. If that's happening at the same time as there's this turmoil in Israel, does that encourage a quick resolution in Jerusalem?
No, I think that would prolong the conflict there. It would further divert U.S. attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which I think is central to conflict in the Middle East and to American interests there. It would only add to the suffering of the Israelis and the Palestinians, I'm afraid, and forestall a renewed peace process.
Ambassador, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Ambassador Philip Wilcox is president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace in Washington. Zev Schiff, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Zev Schiff, military analyst for the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and Sally Reshef. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Reshef is member of the Knesset Labor Party, co-founder of Peace Now. Earlier in the program, we chatted briefly with Cameron Barr, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and Benny Elon, a member of the Knesset as well. Connection listeners, feel free to continue the conversation on our website. We are at theconnection.org. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. Up next on The Connection this Halloween, the answers to some grave questions. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Harvard Bookstore.